Tonight's lecturer, Michael Page, is a member of the Executive Committee, so we know him very well. He studied electronic engineering at Loughborough, which he tells me he subverted at every opportunity to do digital audio systems engineering. After university, he joined Sony Pro Audio Laboratory in Oxford as an R&D engineer, where he conceived and led development of audio networking technologies, which were standardised as AES-50. In 2007, he joined PV Digital Research, where he's head of R&D and leads development of network digital audio systems for commercial installations. And that's what we're going to talk about this evening.
Thank you. Oh, good evening, everyone. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it takes to wire really, really big installations for sound. So here are a couple of them. I've got a big stadium and an airport there. And how does this thing work? Oh yes, there we go. So here are some examples of some of the kind of installations that I'm talking about. There's an airport there, cruise ship, there's a big stadium that I'm sure you'll all recognise, concert hall, a rather famous legislature, ports, casinos are a particularly good one. They have huge and extraordinarily complex systems. Industrial facilities, shopping malls, and so what you might think, you know, what does it take to wire up that kind of sound system? Well, here's one place where we wired up the sound. This is Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta. And as Google Maps tells us, it's not a small place. There's six terminals there. There's something like, I'd guess, about 200 airport gates. And this picture from end to end, you can just see from the size of the planes, is probably about a mile and a half. So it's a pretty huge facility. So here's the problem. You want to wire this place up for sound. How are you going to go about it? Well, let's think about how many discrete audio system outputs we're going to need for something like that. So to start with, it's fairly obvious that every gate in that airport is going to need a unique sound output so that it can have paging that is specific to that gate. So right away, we have about 200 audio zones, one for each gate. But there's a lot more to an airport than just the departure gates, of course. You've got all the other facilities. You've got the concourses and the walkways. You've got the check-in areas there. So let's think about it. We've got every gate. We've got all the lounges. We've got every check-in zone. We have every arrival area. We've got those other areas in arrivals, like all the different customs halls, all the different baggage pickup halls, and all the open concourses, which, if they're large, have to be split into individual zones anyway, partly for life safety evacuation things, and partly just to get the audibility right, because, for example, if a concourse has a stepped roof, then the area where the roof is higher is going to need different processing applied to the loudspeakers in that part where the roof is lower. Time alignment is the obvious thing that comes to mind, so that somebody standing underneath the split in the ceiling height where it changes gets the sound coming to them at the same time, and so they get a coherent signal. So when you start considering this, you realise that you're going to have something of the order of several hundred different audio output zones. So what sort of processing are we going to need for each of those output zones? Well, obviously you need level control for each one so that they're adjusted independently. And it needs potentially independent, different audio signals to be routed to different zones at different times. You need probably going to need some room EQ. You're going to need some loudspeaker EQ, because the kinds of loudspeakers used can obviously vary quite a lot. As I mentioned before, you need time alignment. An interesting piece of processing that's often needed for this kind of thing is ambient leveling. And if you imagine a departures hall when it's completely empty, or maybe there's only half a dozen people in there. Typically these places are very reverberant, with beautiful polished floors and high, hard ceilings. And so it doesn't take a great deal of sound energy going into that room to create something that's fairly audible. But if you put 3,000 people in there who are all trying to get out in a panic, there's going to be a huge, huge ambient level from the people. And so you need to ensure that the level of the audio signals you're putting in are not only appropriate for the kind of content it is, whether it's background music or an emergency evacuation announcement, but you need to make sure that it is adapted to the level of ambient noise. So essentially, the audio signals perceived by the listeners have a given signal-to-noise ratio relative to the ambient noise. So the way you do that is you have microphones around that can measure the ambient level of the noise in there. But the problem is that if you are feeding audio into the room at the same time as you're trying to take that measurement, then you've got an invalid measurement, and if you don't do anything else, you'll just get a feedback loop. It'll get louder and louder and go wrong. So what you need to do is some kind of DSP that can remove from the microphone signal the audio content that is correlated to the signal being fed into the room. So typically you would do that by estimating the impulse response from the loudspeaker back to the microphone. You take the signal going to the loudspeaker, feed it through an estimation of that impulse response, subtract it, and hey presto, it works. You can then put that into a meter. That gives you an estimate of the ambient level in the room, that is the signal that is not the microphone, that's not due to the loudspeaker. Then you can use that level to alter the gain of your signal going into the room to make sure that people hear the announcement. Anyway, so that's a bit about the output. What might you need for the inputs in this system? Well, as I mentioned before, you have all the gates with the independent sound systems in them, and clearly every gate has its own paging station for making the local announcements for when the flight is ready to board or whatever. And then you've got a bunch of other paging systems around the airports as well. For example, every information desk has a paging station. Probably every check-in zone has a paging station. The arrivals hall, the customs, they all have paging stations. So you've probably got, I don't know, 300, 400 paging stations around the airport. Then you've got other sources. In the lounges, you're probably going to have background music. You're going to have the automated messages playing out for things like the security announcements, telling people not to leave their bags alone and irritating them. You have, of course, the life safety systems, the fire evacuation system. So you need inputs for that and ensure that they are prioritized and handled correctly so that if there is, for example, background music playing, or if there is one of the automated please don't leave your bags lying around messages playing, and the fire alarm goes off, then the fire alarm announcement will take priority over the lower priority message and cut in correctly. So, as you can see, there's a very wide range of inputs and a huge number of outputs. And so we've got thousands of loudspeakers, because each zone probably has more than one loudspeaker. And finally, we need to think about the redundancy of the system. If a bomb goes off, or half the building is burning down, or if there is a mains power outage for half an hour, the system needs to keep on working, and it needs to do that in order for the building to have its fire safety certificate. And when you have a system of this scale trying to get that redundancy to work in a robust and smooth way is another big engineering challenge in itself. So a question I'll leave with you for a minute is, how might one do this? So I've spoken a bit about airports. I want to talk about some other applications as well. This is Wembley Stadium. So, we've got this facility. What's it going to take to wire this for sound? Well, clearly we need to get sounds to every one of those seats in there in a high-quality, intelligible way with similar kind of level, whichever seat you're in around the stadium. And it's clear that that the acoustics processing required to get sound to something like a seat up here is going to be very, very different to the acoustics processing needed to get sound to a seat down here, if my mouse would give up on the mouse, it doesn't work. For example, there are loudspeakers attached to this gantry up here that are pointing down at these upper seats. And so you can see the distance is relatively short, and you're going to be getting quite a lot of reflection from this part of the canopy here. Whereas if you're trying to get sound down into here or into here, the sound is having to be projected an enormous vertical distance. It's going to need extraordinarily well-controlled dispersion to avoid having a mushy sound from overlapping fields from adjacent speakers. And so the acoustics are completely different. And you can see that you're essentially going to need independent level, time delay, and equalization processing for pretty much every single block of seats in the stadium. So right from the start there, you've got, several tens, at least 50 different outputs there. But of course, there's a lot more to a stadium than just the seating areas. There are all the VIP boxes, the VIP lounges, there's the restaurants, the bars, the press rooms, the changing rooms, there's the foyers, there's the car parks, there's the conference centres. All of these individual rooms throughout the facility need an independent sound output with independent processing to adapt it for the acoustic characteristics there. So again, we're getting into several hundred different audio outputs. Now, in something like a stadium, you probably don't have as many inputs as in an airport, because you probably don't have as many paging stations. There's probably only a few tens of paging stations, and then during a game, it's typically just a couple of commentators, maybe a broadcast feed, and a DJ, perhaps. So that's a little bit more controlled. The ambient level sensing is even more critical in a stadium than in an airport, because the thing with a stadium is that you get a tremendous difference in the ambient sound level between one half of the stadium and the other half of the stadium at critical times. And the losing fans are not going to be particularly amused to be getting blasted with 120 dBSPL announcement at the time when 10,000 people around them are all silent. So, again, that needs this kind of ambient level processing. And the last application I'd like to talk about is theme parks. This is the Terminator 2 3D ride at Universal Studios. And you can see that there's all sorts of synchronized mechatronics and pyrotechnics and lighting effects and video replay. And it's all controlled by very complex motion control systems. And it's all one synchronized experience for the audience. So the audio system is a really integral part of the experience for this kind of attraction. So clearly there's the usual kind of stuff. There's going to be probably just a handful of different zones in this particular ride. But the way that the audio system works has to be very precisely controlled by the computer sequencing systems that control the ride overall. And again, it needs to be tied into life safety systems. It needs to be redundant. But when you consider that over the scale of the overall theme park, you might have maybe 10 major attractions like that. And then there's the other facilities around the park. For example, you've got the concessions, the open areas, you've got the waiting areas for the rides where they need to play background music at different levels and different styles to get the crowd sort of worked up and keep them patient while they're in the line, whilst gently teasing them with little adverts for all the concessions around. things like, think of the Disney parade grounds. You've got a large open area with lots of distributed loudspeakers and maybe some of them on delay towers. And then the parade moves, you might have 50 channels of radio microphones plus a whole load of other audio feeds coming in. So for that, you end up with a large number of inputs and outputs. that all somehow needs to be controlled. So I've spoken a bit about the scale of the problem, and clearly this is not a trivial audio system engineering problem. So how do people go about solving it? Well, in the good old days, they used this kind of stuff to solve it. You had lots and lots and lots of multi-core audio cable. You had tens of thousands of cross points of that punch on patch bay stuff, and lots of racks full of graphic EQs and dynamics processors and routers and mixers and all of that good old analog gear. And it was very difficult to engineer redundancy in a sensible way. It was quite difficult to get any computerized control of the audio signal processing. And every single audio channel anywhere in the system needed an independent, basically three wires for a balanced audio connection, which, if you consider how many inputs and outputs we're talking about, is obviously an immense cost and an immense weight of just physical cabling. So, back in late 80s, early 90s, along came the digital signal processor, which was solved a lot of these problems. And people often talk about the impact of digital signal processors on, for example, mixing consoles. When the first DSP stuff started coming along, late 80s, early 90s. And clearly it had a big impact on what you can do with mixing consoles and opened all sorts of wonderful possibilities. But I would argue that the technical advances in what was possible and the cost-benefit that DSP brought to the installation industry was even greater than that it brought to the mixing console industry. Because what using DSP allows you to do is, firstly, you can have very easy interfacing of your signal processing capability to computers. And so much of the control of media systems in these kind of facilities has been automated for a long, long time. So that was, and if you think about those theme park rides, the whole thing is computerized. So that's a big advantage. The other really big thing this gives you is you can have a modest quantity of generic signal processing hardware, and you can make it do any signal processing you like. Now, with these sort of audio systems, you tend to not have large, regular arrays of the same audio processing functionality as you would in a mixing console. You tend to have little bits here and there. You might have eight channel, sort of 8:2 mixer here, and then a 16:4 mixer here, and then 13 channels of dynamics over there, and three of those channels go into some kind of other processor that combines them and feeds in with an ambient signal, and under a certain condition that will be triggered by a computer that will then play a WAV file, and that will switch in a dynamics processor. So the signal processing involved tends to be very irregular. And digital signal processors are great for that, because the installer can just say, I'm going to buy 30 boxes of DSP, scatter them around my system, program them independently, and they'll do what I need. So that's one half of it. The other half is, of course, audio networking. Now, CobraNet has been the de facto standard for audio networking in commercial audio since it came around in the late 1990s. And it allows us to get, as you're probably aware, some number of channels of audio on a standard Cat5 installed cable. This vastly reduces the amount of cable required to get a given number of audio channels around the place, which has two huge advantages. You save the cost on the cable, you save the cost on the installation of the cable, and it's the cost of the installation of the cable that's a killer. But if you're using networking, all buildings are flood-wired with Cat5 cable, unless they're cathedrals, possibly, but there's not many exceptions now. And you can just use that existing infrastructure very, very efficiently to meet all your audio routing requirements. And the other neat thing is that it implicitly gives you computer-based control of your audio routing. So you don't have to go and buy expensive, specific audio routing equipment to do that function. So, as I mentioned before, this technology, CobraNet, very widely used in commercial installation. It has typically a latency of 5 and a bit milliseconds. It typically carries tens of channels, although you can stack them up onto VLANs over gigabit Ethernet, and then you can get more channels over it that way. It's a bit complicated, though. And it's essentially an Ethernet-based protocol. For those networking gurus among you, it's layer 2. So it is not IP. You can't traverse IP routers with it. But nonetheless, the capabilities of local Ethernet networking are still pretty powerful. Now, just a bit about where I believe audio networking is and is going at the moment. We have recently started in our products to support this technology, Dante, by these Australian guys, Audinate. And what they have done is created what I believe is something pretty much state-of-the-art in audio networking. It uses IP protocol, so you can bridge it across IP routers. It is very scalable in terms of the bandwidth and in terms of the latency. So what that means is that if you're working on a typical infrastructure similar to where you'd use CobraNet, a local Ethernet network with tens of nodes, then you can probably get performance a bit better than CobraNet. You'll get it down to maybe a millisecond latency. You might be able to get 100 channels, 200 channels over it. So it's a sort of incremental improvement. But what you can also do with it in principle is you can say, right, I'm going to increase the latency to be, 100 milliseconds. And in principle, you can implement that and then send it over the internet. Or alternatively, you could say, I'm going to connect my two big boxes together and they're never going to be connected by anything other than a couple of pieces of cable and a switch that I've characterized. So I'm going to increase the channel count to 500 channels and I'm going to wind down the latency to half a millisecond. And their system will still work. So in that respect, I think it's a lot more capable than CobraNet. And I think these kind of capabilities are going to be supported more and more. So I've spoken a bit about the particular technologies, the DSP and the audio networking, and they're typically put together into it's very simplified, topology like this, where you just have the cloud of the Ethernet network that is transporting all your audio data and all your control data between all the nodes. And then you have audio input-output units scattered around it, and they'll typically contain the analog audio interfaces that are going to your loudspeakers or from your paging station microphones. You have digital signal processing units that do the heavy lifting of the signal processing, and of course they don't have to be located near either the audio sources or the audio destinations. They can actually be located anywhere you like in the system, typically inside a big central wiring closet. And then very importantly, you also have control interfaces to your network so that the DSP units can communicate with things like the uninterruptible power supplies, so that it knows if the power supply is failing and it can then switch over to the redundant system. It can communicate with the fire and life safety evacuation systems. It might communicate with the building services management system, which would be controlling the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, perhaps. So there are lots of possibilities for building smart systems, I guess, where all of these different systems in the building are integrated in useful ways. And this is a very successful technology area. There's a number of companies, of which Media Matrix is obviously only one, that are are active and successful in this market. So I'd like to talk a bit about the particular solutions to the problem that Media Matrix has devised. Media Matrix was originally developed in the early 1990s by a company in Colorado called Peak Audio. And they developed this, the original Media Matrix box. So it's a big, it's about that kind of size. It's an industrial computer chassis with a PC-80 motherboard in it, and then an extended industrial ISA backplane. And into that ISA backplane plugs a number of DSP cards that have Motorola 56K DSPs on them. This was launched in 1993 and at the time was revolutionary. The first job they did with it, I believe, was the US Senate chamber. And what they did, I'll explain to you the problem they had there, it's quite an interesting one. The US Senate chamber has a large number of individual desks arranged all around the room for each of the senators. And they have a little box on the desk with a loudspeaker and a microphone. And there are kind of two things that the sound system needs to do. It needs to reproduce the sound of the given speaker, the person who's speaking, so that everyone else in the room can hear it clearly. And the problem with the US Senate chamber is that it's got a high dome ceiling, so putting speakers up there, I'd guess that there might be problems with the status of the building with attaching bloody great speakers to the ceiling. But also, you will have all sorts of problems with the reflections from this great big dome ceiling impairing the intelligibility. So what they had is they used the little loudspeaker in everyone's desk unit to do the job of the sound reinforcement. The other problem, the other thing it needs to do is it needs to be able to intelligibly record everything that goes on in the chamber, provide outputs, well, both for recording and also sometimes for broadcast feeds. Now, the problem of the sound reproduction through the little loudspeakers is interesting because clearly if you've got a live microphone sort of that far away from a loudspeaker reproducing at a good level, it's going to cause dreadful feedback. And so you can say, okay, I'm going to switch off that loudspeaker. Okay, that works. But what about the people next to them? Because you've got a live microphone there and then only maybe a metre and a half away or something, they've got the other loudspeaker. So you say, well, you've got to turn that one off as well. But then they might not be able to hear that well. And so the problem sort of propagates across the room. How close to that desk do you decide you're going to turn their loudspeaker off? And the solution they devised for this is a kind of automatic mixer, whereby the person speaking, their loudspeaker gets turned off. Turned off for the contribution of the signal from their microphone, so it's a kind of mix minus to their local loudspeaker. And then for the people near them, it is a mix minus, but a less severe mix minus. They sort of mix in a bit of it. And then for the people sort of one step further away again, it's just a really subtle sort of ducking down of that signal. And then by the time it's several meters away, it's full level. And implementing that kind of thing with an analog system is just brain damage, frankly. You need a bazillion motorized pots and some massive computer. With DSP, it is not trivial, but certainly very achievable. Anyway, I digress. That was what they built with the original Media Matrix system, and PV entered into a licensing arrangement with Peak Audio at that point, and so it actually became, it was a manufactured and marketed and distributed as a PV product under the Media Matrix brand. Anyway, that was extremely successful. And then in the beginning of this decade, really, they started development of the second generation product, which is this thing here, the Media Matrix Neon, which is a basically quite a... It's a similar kind of thing. Excuse me. It's obviously it's a lot more compact, and I've got a picture under the hood here. This is the main board and the audio networking interface, and we've got all kinds of interesting goodies in here. So this is the CPU, which is, as you might be able to see, is a power PC. This runs a flavour of embedded Linux. And, of course, you can do all sorts of interesting software things with Linux. The network discovery, distributed control architecture, all the software to do that is running on there. Because people typically have a large numbers of these Neons all working together in a big distributed network. Wembley Stadium has 50 of them, for example, all communicating with each other on the network, all doing different parts of the job. And so the PowerPC processor, it communicates on the network through the main control network ports, and it then monitors what the DSPs are doing, sends back metering and status information, and then it sends updates to the DSPs. If you interact with one of the touchscreen controllers and you say you want to turn this section on or you want to increase the level, then it's that CPU that sends the instructions to the DSPs to alter their gain coefficients or whatever. Up here we have the DSPs. This particular board is for the slightly cheaper product that has three DSPs, but you can see it's the same circuit board. The more expensive one has all six positions fitted with the DSPs. The DSPs are Analog Devices Shark. It's a floating point DSP that is in many ways quite optimal for audio signal processing, very popular for digital audio products. And so those DSPs have some RAM there for doing delay-based processing, and there's an FPGA that handles the communication between the main CPU and all the DSPs here. Over here we have a thing called XDAB, the External Digital Audio Bus, which is a proprietary 512-channel, essentially a bus linking device. So it operates as a ring bus, 512 channels, and the idea is that Neon units can be clustered together with this very, very high bandwidth link between them for distributing some of the distributing DSP over multiple devices. If there's too much processing for one box or for other reasons. So that's handled with these chips over here. What else have we got? This is the CobraNet module that's actually made by Cirrus Logic, the people who do CobraNet. So PV buys that module from them, and so it's got the Ethernet physical layer chips there, and then the FPGA and some other bits and pieces that handles the actual CobraNet protocol in real time. Because the CobraNet protocol deals with such high bandwidths of audio and such low latency that you can't really implement it in a general purpose processor running a full operating system, which is why there's this custom hardware module to handle CobraNet. What else do we have? There's a bunch of circuitry here for the GPIO section. So on this 25-pin connector, there's a whole bunch of inputs and outputs for connections to other control things. There's a load of general-purpose digital inputs, general-purpose digital outputs, analog control voltage inputs. Some of them are powered, so that, for example, you can get a powered control voltage input, and you can just wire it straight to a pot and have that in a wall plate, and so you have a pot on a wall, and it's actually going and controlling a parameter in the digital system to, for example, turn the level up and down of the gain of the room, but you can actually use that pot to control anything you like. High current outputs, all sorts of bits and pieces in there, really. And then the rest of it is just all the power supplies and other stuff to keep it ticking over happily. So that's the Neon, that's the hardware side of it. Now the really interesting side is I think, the software side, which I will show you now. So this is our application called Enware, which is used for actually defining what the signal processing is going to be to solve these kind of sound system design problems. And I'd like to... Yeah, doing okay for time. I'd like to just go through creating a simple design to show you how this kind of thing works, because it really is a very interesting piece of software. So let's start off. We're going to build our sound system. Let's take a Neon N6 processor, and so we're going to give it an 8-channel input card, and we're going to tell it we're going to use CobraNet, and we want to configure the general purpose I/O. Fine, and so I was explaining to you about the GPIO section on it for interfacing to other control systems. Each of those pins on the back can do all kinds of interesting things. You've got some word clock, and you've got the high current outputs, and there's all sorts of things. Anyway, this one I'm going to say let's use the digital input. So you could, this is a 3.3-volt, I think it might be 5-volt compatible TTL logic input that can come from some other system. Okay. So now I should have on here inputs and outputs that have become available. So Neon number one, yes, slot one. Right, I've got 8 input channels. Oops. So I've got my 8 input channels there, and go to the CM1, which is the CobraNet interface. Let's have some output channels from the CobraNet interface. Good. Right, so I've got my inputs, and I'm going to want to do some processing to those inputs in a fairly conventional sort of way. So let's create a block that I can then go and reuse for my input processing. Let's call it input processing. I'll just change the height so it looks neat. Right, so that was just an empty block that I can go and I can put other functionality in, and then I can repeat it or use it elsewhere as I want. So in here I've got the input and my output, and I can put stuff in the middle. So let's start with putting, I think having this kind of application is an automatic gain control would be a sensible thing to have in the dynamics. There we go. Automatic gain control. I'll come here. Great. And then let's have a 3-band parametric EQ. And yeah, I think that's all we need there. So take my wiring tool, wire these up. And if I go and open these, it shows me the control panels for these devices. So these are the controls that are available for the automatic gain control. So you can see this quite detailed level of control there. And I want to put some of these things onto the controls page for this block. So let's say I'm going to take the bypass control for the AGC, and I want to rename that's to be AGC bypass, and then I want to take all the controls for my parametric EQ, because we're probably going to use them more frequently. Put them there. Okay, so I've now got the control panels for a typical bunch of input processing, and now I just need to copy and paste for all my inputs. Neaten them up a bit, put them there. Right, so that's the input processing. Now let's go and get a mixer. I want to have, what do I want? I want to custom mixer, don't I? Let's have 10 inputs and 4 outputs. Okay, and then I want to create a block for my output processing, so I can go and do a similar kind of thing with a general purpose block, but I want a 1 input 2 output, and into here I want to put where are they dancing the filters? I want to have a two-way 12 dB per octave crossover. So say I'm going to be having a high and low frequency loudspeakers on these 8 outputs in 4 sets, then this is the kind of processing we would use. And let's have some delays on here. So I want to have my delays, I want to be able to calibrate my delays in meters, because that's pretty handy, with a maximum delay of 10 meters, and obviously only one tap. So this is pretty useful for acoustic applications. And wire these up. No, that's not what I wanted to do. And I could go and create a control panel for that in the same way as I did before, but in the interest of making not all fall asleep, I won't bother. So we've got our, I'll just rename that to be the output processing. Right. So now I can start wiring these all up. Oops. So that's the basic processing there. Now another thing I would like to do is I want to be able to play back an audio message in response to an external command. So let's get a WAV file player, stereo. That's what I want, 48k. Good, a WAV file player, and I can hook this up here into our mixer control, and I need to go and get that. I need to access that digital input that I specified for the Neon earlier. So if I go into the settings for the actual Neon, I can go and get the. This is an LED, a virtual LED device in the software that will light up when a logic signal is applied to that digital input, general purpose pin on the Neon. So what I can do is I say, all right, I'm going to take that little LED from there, do a copy on it, and paste it down here. And then in here I'm going to go and get the play button from the WAV file player device and paste it there. And then if I just say this one I want to be able to control wire to it in slave mode, this one I want to control wire port on it in master mode, and then if I just draw a wire between them, that has linked them together. So that now if there's a digital input signal on that pin, it'll actually trigger the WAV file player and set it going. So one final thing, I need an output where all this stuff is going to go, so I can get an amplifier. So if I get an 8-channel amplifier, and I can drop it on there, and we can see we've got all the controls for remote control of an amplifier. And so let's see what happens when I try generating the code for this. So what's happened here is I've gone into a thing called emulation mode, which checks all of the control capability. It goes and checks how much signal processing resource is needed to implement this design in the Neon devices. Now, if I had a Neon box here with me, what I would do is I would have it connected to the same network as my laptop, and instead I would press this button here, which is deploy. That would go and generate the DSP codes to run on the Shark DSPs, and it would generate the control configuration that will run on the PowerPC host processor in that Neon. It'll generate all of that code, and then it will download it over the network to the Neon, which will get it, unpack it, start and start the whole process up. And at that point, the two things will be connected together and communicating. But by pressing this emulate button, it has a virtual Neon in software in the laptop that does everything except the actual DSP. That's now running. We can have a look at the resource report here, which shows how much of each DSP chip on the device is busy, and we can see that the total DSP usage for this design is just under 15% of the processing available in that box. So if you think that Wembley have 50 of these boxes pretty much maxed out, you realise that's a pretty epic amount of DSP they're using in that stadium. So I hope that gives you an idea of the kind of processing that is available with these sorts of systems. And you can by drawing arbitrary combinations of DSP on the screen like this, and then relying on an algorithm to allocate that most efficiently to the generic signal processing hardware available, it suits the kind of very irregular processing requirements for commercial installations. Now, in the sort of Blue Peter spirit of here's one that was made earlier, I got here a particularly interesting project. This is the file, come over, for Emirates Stadium, which is put together with, I don't know how many, but I think it's a large number of Neons. And what they have done is they've used the graphical capabilities of this Enware software to create user interfaces that are displayed on touchscreen terminals. So I can't emulate this because it needs such a huge number of Neons that my PC falls over if I hit the emulate button, because it is a truly gargantuan project. I'll go through some of the other bits in a minute. But what they've done is they've taken an architectural plan of the stadium here for this display that's going to be on like a giant touchscreen. And then they have overlaid button controls over the outline of the different sectors on this picture, so that the user can go and press an area on here and then select what the signal, what the source is going to be, or can select an evacuation message, or can set the volume somewhere on there. There's a paging station function, I think. Maybe that's on a different one. A great application for this kind of thing is selecting the paging. So you've got decide which sectors you want to page, just select them all on the screen, and then you just press the paging button, speak into the mic, and it goes to those sectors, and then it can clear it again. I'll just browse through here, and I'll show you some of the other stuff in this file to give you an idea of the scale. Rack status, what's going on here? So this is monitoring the status of all the racks. So this is the status coming from the amplifiers, which are all being communicated with via IP. There's all the UPSs, which are probably communicating with on serial ports. There's a scripting environment, a script programming environment in here, so you can actually write scripts in Python that execute on the processing boxes and can communicate via their network ports or their serial ports. And using that, you can implement arbitrary serial protocols. So if you've got a UPS from some manufacturer that has some kind of serial communications protocol for control and status, you can actually just implement that. Have it running on the sound processing boxes, and so they can monitor the status of their own UPSs and behave appropriately. So, and status of loudspeakers and input metering. So there's lots and lots of input meters. Rack status, that's similar stuff. What is going on here? This is lots of control scripts and some very complicated control stuff I don't understand. More complicated, all of this stuff is control wiring. So these things here are control scripts that are being written in Python. It's called a zone aggregator. We can probably look at that. Probably won't mean a great deal. So where are we? Zone aggregator. Oh, it pops up over here. So that's just a simple thing. So it's a piece of functionality that couldn't be achieved easily any other way, so it's just got a script to do it. Here is more user interface stuff for setting audio source selections for different areas. Some visual representations of all the amplifiers. So this has clearly been set up to be a visual representation of how they appear in the racks, so they can look at it and see, oh, if it's that one flashes a red light, well, they know it's in the northwest bowl in this particular rack, and it's the seventh one's down or whatever. So this is all the routing for the TV input, it says. So there's a lot of inputs there, meters, which are displayed here, 32 by 32 cross-point router matrix, gain controls, delays can all be set up individually, and then that is all going to a CobraNet connection here that's going for, I don't know, some other point in the system, I guess. Yep, gain controls for the TV, that's probably related to what we saw on the page before. There is a large amount of I.O. Anyway, you get the idea. It is a huge, huge system with a lot of connections to all sorts of bits of third-party gear. And anyway, that's it. Thank you.
Start out. I'm sure lots of people want to know, how much does all this cost? I'm fascinated as to how much it costs to implement this type of system.
The N6 processor box, if you get it with all four analog I/O slots fully loaded, comes in at something like 5,000 quid.
And then the design of the system to make it all work.
The software is free for download. But clearly the development cost of that software is wrapped into the hardware box because developing this kind of software is a lot. There's all sorts of consultants out there making very good livings doing this sort of work, because clearly putting together a project like this is probably about a man-year's work.
And do you know how much that costs typically?
No. Have a guess. How much do good consultants cost?
Questions sure. From the floor, please.
No,
please.
Jeremy, sorry. Would you expect the client to actually understand enough about this to do their own maintenance, or would this entirely be a professional operation?
It depends on how bold the client is. No, it's typically a professional operation. There are lots of specialists in this technology and the similar technology from our competitors. And typically, all the clients ever engage with is these nice, you know, user interfaces like this. Pretty simple.
So is there software with the emulator free to download and you can
Absolutely.
Play and do everything?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Go to just mediamatrix.pv.com and it's free to download. It's called Nware. Get it.
Hello.
Sorry? Yeah, it's Windows PC. Yeah. Sorry, Mark.
Hi there. So I noticed the monitoring runs on SNMP, so I was wondering how stringent the quality of service must be on the data aspect of the Ethernet.
So are you talking about for the audio processing or just for the control monitoring?
For the monitoring, so the audio will be layer 2, and I'm wondering how much higher layer stuff is going on, and do you ever find that the constrictions on bandwidth will impaired, like the ability of an SNMP MIB to get its data across?
We haven't encountered any problems with that. The control processing is it's all IP, apart from the discovery protocol, which isn't. But yeah, we generally I'm not aware of people with our systems ever having encountered control bandwidth processing for that kind of thing.
Okay. And another one.
Sure.
With the PowerPC architecture,
yeah.
I presume there must have been quite a lot of benefits to going with that over x86.
It was certainly true sort of 6-7 years ago when they were doing the architecture stage for this product, and it's still pretty much true now that if you are looking to build products of the order of hundreds or thousands a year, designing the circuit board yourself, and you want your total... the total bill of materials cost for your CPU embedded system to be less than $500, you can't use x86 because Intel or AMD won't support you for putting down the CPU, the North Bridge, the South Bridge, whatever, onto a board, and in any case it's a lot more expensive. Now the PowerPC on there is only, it's a 200 megahertz device, so it's not massively powerful, but it is somewhere between $10 and $30, I don't recall exactly. For the whole integrated, it's a CPU and a memory controller and the Ethernet interface and a bazillion general purpose I.O. things on a $20 chip. So it's really in a different space to x86. That is changing to an extent with Intel's current strategy of embedded systems, but we're not there yet. Clearly it's possible to solve these kind of problems using x86 processors, but the lowest spec, the sort of lowest price point, spec point box you can do with x86 is much higher than what you can do with this kind of embedded architecture.
Can I just say to the gentleman earlier, I have actually seen a competitor's system struggling very much with bringing back control data, particularly when they had a screen with 200 VU meters on it showing the output from every amp.
Right, okay.
When they turned that off, it got a lot better.
In terms of using the end user using the program, is there any sort of built-in automation to allow a lot of the processes to run by themselves?
I don't quite understand. What do you mean by built-in automation?
So an engineer could set it up so that most of the processes that go on happen automatically, and the end user only has a limited amount of buttons. Otherwise,
absolutely.
I presume you'd have to have an audio engineer involved to run the system.
No, you're absolutely right. These systems will generally be configured so that, if I can find where that AFC main, this was the one. Yeah. They'll generally be configured so that on a touchscreen terminal that the stadium operator uses, they will only get, say, this screen and the other ones they can access through those controls there. And all of the other ones with all of the schematic content on them, all the wiring stuff, is not going to be available to them. And there are, you can have different users with different access levels. Different physical user interface devices can have different subsets of the available content of the project rendered to them. So there is a very flexible permission system there, and it can ultimately be as simple as a volume control and a mute button, with arbitrarily complex functionality linked to that volume control and mute button.
Just the obvious question with complex embedded systems, what happens when it crashes? I imagine it must occasionally.
It'll go silent.
Go offline.
Yeah, if there's a critical problem, it'll... It'll go silent. The mute relays will go, and that's why you typically have redundant systems. Doesn't happen often, though. One thing that can cause a problem with it is that, in a sense, you know, this is a very flexible and powerful system, but it's arguably flexible and powerful to the point that we give these system installers enough rope to hang themselves with. So, I mentioned there's a scripting system with Python scripts. Now, it's perfectly possible to crash a Neon by writing a Python script with a fatal error in it. And there's kind of a, you know, in the design philosophy of it, you get into this trade-off. How much do you limit the users? And what we've tend to find is that the people who are using Enware seriously, this is their day job. They do it year in, year out, all the time, and they become very, very good at it. And they complain more about not having as much power and flexibility as they'd like than they complain about the scope for Neons to crash because they've got something wrong. So that's what our customers want, so we do it that way. And some of them create the most mind-boggling hacks, I have to say.
Yes, I guess the other advantage you've got then from a hardware point of view is it's probably got a long life in terms it can stay in production for quite a few years because everybody wants a stable system. It's the opposite we have in CE, where every 6 months they want a new one, and of course you've no chance to... even get it stable.
Yeah. We are, I think we are still making the original Media Matrix mainframe. We've been trying to stop for ages, and people keep on still ordering them and waving lots of money at us. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, clearly they've been making it since 1993, and you run into end of life problems with some of the components. Yeah. So.
Okay, thank you.
Well, the mic's here. Thanks. How do you achieve the physical redundancy of the cabling networks? Is there any particular measure that you have to take? For example, if cable's routed through an area that's on fire?
Well, just use networking redundancy schemes. So you would have a pair of CobraNet links. CobraNet has two ports on it, primary and secondary. And so you can run them onto independent networks with switches that are physically separated so that if one Neon gets destroyed or taken offline or starts, you know, spewing crap onto the network, then that'll happen on one network perhaps and not the other. Or if one switch is destroyed, then there's another network available.
Yeah, so it'd be kind of organic in a way that the signal, if it can't take the shortest path, it would go around the long way.
Yeah, kind of. Certainly for the control networking, that's the case. For CobraNet has its own redundancy mechanism. It's a sort of parallel network.
And the other thing I was going to ask about is you, obviously on that example, there are TV studios and video signals of one kind or another. What's the integration with the video side of things?
It's done through the control interfaces. So if you've got a video router, it can be controlled and monitored via a serial port interface. And actually, we just put together a lot of software components, and they're in the kind of prototype stage at the moment that we demonstrated at the recent Infocom show, with high definition cameras and monitors and, you know, pan tilt zoom and displaying the video monitoring on touchscreen controllers and the whole thing integrated with the audio system.
I did wonder, because there's always a bit of an argument between who gets priority with the sound and the vision.
Yeah.
They managed to agree on who's in control.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this software. It looks quite nice, but I can't fail to notice the similarities with MaxMSP. And I would like to ask if there are contributors contributing software code in terms of, I saw there the DSP processes, you have some delays, some EQs.
Yep.
Maybe, you know, maybe there's an area there where development required in terms of designing codes. Is there an aspect like a forum or a way where people contribute?
No, I think it's possibly coincidental, the visual similarity. I mean, you could argue, for instance, that the similarity in the block diagram is like Simulink. It's just another symbolic block diagram manipulation thing that happens to be used for audio. There's certainly no overlap between this and MaxMSP. I'm not very familiar with MaxMSP, but it's a kind of sound design and DSP environment, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very, very similar. I mean, the logic is exactly the same, but the thing is, for example, when you have the box of a delay there, you can actually go inside and manipulate the delay itself, not as a graphical representation, but as a code. So you can add more processes into it. So in this point, I just want to ask, I mean, what about the updates of these codes? Do they update regularly? If there is a need for a better delay or a better EQ, are there people working on these codes?
Well, we've got pretty much every sort of delay and EQ type you could ever want implemented already. The one thing I would say about Enware and the predecessor of Enware for the old Media Matrix system was a piece of software called Mware, and I think that was released in 93 or 94, which was, I think, it was probably before Max MSP. But to address your other point, each signal processing block on there, the EQ algorithm or a router or gain, has a piece of DSP code associated with it. And when the design compiler sees that an EQ, for example, has been instantiated, the DSP compiler links in that piece of DSP code into the overall binary for the DSP, and then it zips it up, sends it over the network to the Neon with the instructions on how to interface it and which chip to put it on, and the Neon then packs it and loads it into the DSP. And that's not available to the end users. That's not editable. Programming SIMD architecture Shark DSPs is not a job for amateurs. So it's impractical and inappropriate, and besides, we've got clever stuff about how we implement some of that thing, so, you know, we don't want people to know. So I think it's the similarity with things like MaxMSP is superficial and maybe coincidental.
Simple question. Can you change the phase on your mic input so to eliminate feedback at low frequencies when you've got a monitor quite close, as you were giving an earlier example?
Yeah, sure. You could do that. The alternative is, where is it? You use one of these gadgets here, a feedback ferret, which is a feedback suppressor device, which will do the same job more effectively. But yeah, every function that you would expect to find in a conventional mixing console is here. And that functionality is about 10% of the overall palette of tools available. If you want to have a look at the mic input controls, those are the mic inputs. So you've got, phantom power, mute, invert, solo, and then you've got analog gain control, which goes in 3 dB steps, and a digital trim.
Could you talk about the difference between Cobranet and Dante, and
sure.
how you foresee Dante possibly taking over in the future?
Yeah, Cobranet was the one that kicked it all off. It was revolutionary. It is, I believe, very much a technology of its time. And the capabilities of what is possible in silicon now is a long way beyond where it was 15 years ago. So Dante takes advantage of not only those developments in silicon capability, but also in networking protocol development. For example, using things like IEEE 1588 for the timing, the precision time protocol, which is rapidly gaining universal acceptance as the way to solve that kind of timing problem. It does so very efficiently and effectively. My personal view is that the way Dante solves these problems is the right way to do this. I think Dante is technically very good. I am less certain about whether they will succeed commercially. I mean, they've got a very strong case and they've got a lot of backing, but you don't know. It's hard selling digital audio networking technology as a Even Charles Anderson, who founded Peak Audio, would say. I think they're probably the best game in town at the moment, but we'll have to wait and see.
Could I ask about wide area networking? Because
sure.
Dante are talking about scalability into
yep.
not just gigabit, mm. but terabit, which is hugely frightening. In terms of what you can do with it.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Oh, well, there we go.
What do you need for the
there's a free one.
Yeah. I don't know much about what Ordinator are planning with wide area networking. Because they've built a very scalable protocol, then clearly if you've got the quality of service and you've got the buffers big enough to accommodate your worst case latency, it ought to just work. It obviously won't work with their existing transceiver implementations, but you know they've got the protocol and the infrastructure there, and building the transceivers is pretty straightforward. So I don't quite understand the application they might have in mind for that sort of scale. Clearly, having sort of campus area networking I could see being quite useful. But beyond that, I'm not sure.
Well, you actually mentioned it, video.
Okay, yeah. I know that there's no reason why the Dante transport can't be used to convey video data. If you've got substantially more than a gigabit available, then you can do uncompressed 1080p. So, I don't know where that sits on their technology development priorities, but it's clearly possible.
Okay, one final question. Are you recommending putting in fiber or copper in buildings?
I don't know that I'm personally qualified to answer that question. I think that's probably a good question for our system installers, who are professionals and actually practicing this. My guess is that it would depend on how much bandwidth you need. If it's all just gigabit and you don't need to get it more than 100 meters, I don't see the problem with copper, but I don't know.
Well, it goes back to the integration of video and
okay.
audio. With the universal system clock and the idea that you can send out to any device
mm.
and it'll automatically sync up, or by its nature it will sync up audio and video,
right.
Then I think that's probably the application. because you were talking about the Emirates Stadium.
Yep.
And I noticed that on your diagram you actually had delays for the scoreboard and all that kind of
right.
stuff. But with Dante, you'll be able to just send it out and the device will say, oh, system clock, event happens, blah, blah, blah. Does that make
right.
sense?
Yeah, it does. And so I guess if you're dealing with that kind of bandwidth, then fibre makes sense.
I've heard one or two people say that gigabit over twisted pair, you get bit errors in a way you don't with 100 meg.
You don't with what, sorry?
With 100 megabit. I mean, this was someone saying why he was using 100 meg. But
I hadn't actually heard that. It's, I suppose, not entirely surprising. But if people are finding that in the field, then it's a good argument for installing fiber instead of copper. We don't actually particularly care. Provided that we can get at least 100 megabit of bandwidth clear, either as a 100 megabit VLAN or using some other means of assuring that, then certainly CobraNet will work just fine, and I believe Dante will as well.
But if your link, I mean, if you're using, do you have install base that's using gigabit?
Most of our places use gigabit, yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, if you're getting bit errors, you are going to get impairments in the audio, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely right. And I know that it is pretty conventional for the gigabit backbone networking to be done on fibre. And, of course, I would imagine they're using mostly 10 gigabit for the connections between switches. But that's a question of what is good practice for data comms installation. I guess I do take your point that there could be a conflict there between the requirements, the standard practice maybe for data comms installation. Versus
yeah, I mean, for data, well, you know, you lose a few packets, yeah. You send them again, you know.
Yeah, I have to say that I haven't heard of that being a problem in our systems, but...
And you do use gigabit over copper?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other questions from the floor? It seems not. Michael, thank you very much indeed. I'd never thought of airport audio as interesting before, but you've opened my eyes. Thanks very much, and hope to see you all again in October. Thank you.
Thank you.